Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we tell the story of the politics and events behind history's biggest wars, and we also chat with historians, filmmakers, and authors about war. Today, we're sitting down with Stephen G. Rabe. He's the author of The Lost Paratroopers of Normandy, a story of resistance, courage, and solidarity in a French village. He is a professor of history at the University of Texas at Dallas, the recipient of multiple awards for his literary works, and he also served on active and reserve duty in the U.S. Marine Corps. Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
For having me. Thanks very much. I should add one thing is I'm now retired. I retired in 2017 from UT Dallas, and then I taught a little bit at the University of Oregon, where I live in Oregon now, but now I'm completely retired.
Does that title ever leave you, or you're like, you're still a professor of history, I feel like, just forever?
What I have is emeritus status, yes. But no, I've always wanted to be a teacher, always wanted to teach at the university level. And probably the thing that I miss the most is interacting with students.
I can imagine.
I'm now completely retired. I don't miss creating papers, and I don't miss that the dog ate my homework. I miss interacting with.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but, it's really fun to have somebody to talk about history with, for sure. That's one of the things I enjoy about this podcast the most. So your book, The Lost Paratroopers of Normandy, it's something that some people have heard about. Maybe there's like a couple documentaries, but I've never seen, I never went so in depth with their story and what happened until I read your book. They were mostly of the 82nd Airborne Division, a little bit of the 101st Airborne Division. Is that right?
That is correct. That is correct. There were nine planes of members of the 82nd Airborne and one plane of the 101st, all badly off target, like landing some 20 miles off target. That, as it turned out, other people wandered into this small village. It was a fairly chaotic situation in Normandy during the first 2 years.
Right. So they're part of this massive airborne operation on D-Day, June 6, 1944. They're supposed to land on Omaha Beach, and they got blown off course. Rockets, total Star Wars style, like enemy fire at them, just chaos. And tell us a little bit about that crazy landing that happened.
The 101st Airborne and the 82nd Airborne landed six regiments of about 12,000 men on D-Day. Some were to land behind Utah Beach. Others were to land behind, basically most were to land behind Utah Beach. We would probably say that 85% of them were off target. They're off target because, as you mentioned, terrible flak when they came across the Cotentin Peninsula on present-day Normandy. Also, the weather was very poor. It was very clear going across the English Channel, and the men were just amazed seeing all the ships in the sea. It was a beautiful sea, and the moon was shining on the sea, and it was almost uplifting to them. But once they crossed the Normandy coast, a very deep cloud banks came in, and then very intense fire. Now, the men that we're speaking about here came in the last wave, and by that time, the Germans really knew that they were being attacked, and so everything they had, they were loading on the planes coming in. So this particular group of paratroopers that we're speaking about were, as a group, the farthest off target. They were some 20 miles off target, and that presented an enormous dilemma to them. They also, because of the flak and of the weather, they often landed or jumped from very low altitudes, often 350 to 500 feet.
Yeah.
In the case, my father is one of these paratroopers, and he told the story that normally when his parachute opened, his helmet would fall across his face, and that his first maneuver would be to move his helmet back up above his eyes. And when he did that on D-Day at 2:38 a.m. in the morning, he hit ground. That's how low he had jumped. I mean, probably his parachute had one oscillation before he hit ground. The other thing, of course, that these meant is the Germans had flooded the area, that intelligence had not picked up that the entire area was quite flooded. They had backed up the rivers. Well, unfortunately, several paratroopers became entangled in their parachutes and drowned.
And you go over quite a bit of that in detail in the book, too, where we're talking broken bones smashed against the rocks. And one guy you said had been hit in the head while he was standing in the doorway, and their plane was taking a nosedive, and people were trying to jump off, and some couldn't make it. And just for our listeners out there, the normal lowest safe distance to jump from is 3,500 feet or something like that.
Well, they would often in practice do about 1,000 to 1,200 feet. It is to the paratrooper's advantage to jump as low as possible because you don't want to be in the air because you can't fire back or anything like that. But pilots of the C-47 transport planes were also very young and inexperienced. They're extremely nervous. The flak was very, very intense. It was a very, very chaotic situation. Nonetheless, yeah. most of the men made it to the ground, and they did drop the 6,000 paratroopers from the U.S. 82nd 101st Division, but almost all of them were badly off target. Some only a mile, maybe perhaps mile, 2 to 3 miles off. But in this case, this group was as a group, the farthest off target, some 20 miles from their intended.
That's incredible. One of the things that stayed with me that you described was this villager in Grenya, who, you know, which is the village that's 20-ish miles away from the Omaha Beach where they were supposed to land. So this villager could see the expression of one of the paratroopers' faces in the doorway of the plane as the plane scraped across the roofs and as it was landing. And she could see his expression. That's how close it was. And it was just this, and like some guy died, like landed in a burning building and died, and it was just madness, total madness. And this is like 160 paratroopers we're talking about, roughly, right?
Well, they're totally, those particular two incidents you mentioned were over the town of San Marie Igle, where they could see the faces of the paratroopers. And yes, one man landed in a burning building. Another man crashed through a hothouse, a kind of glass hothouse where you would grow vegetables during the winter, etc. It was extremely difficult. And in the village of Grenya, which is about 10 miles from the port town of Caratop, that as of 165, several men died from basically the basic problem that was drowning. Other people, they had injuries, they had stress fractures, ankle fractures, etc. Other men, when they landed in the water, were frantic to get out of their parachutes. So they were taking their knives and splashing away at the risers to get out of the parachute. But inevitably, then they cut their hands and have really severe cuts on their hands, et cetera, that the battalion medic had to take care of.
Horrible, horrible. And it's so, one of the things you also described a little bit, and I don't want to give away too much, but one of the things you described was, stuck with me, this German commander, this like Nazi paratrooper group that was kind of nearby watching what was going on. And they were just in kind of a state of panic for a little bit and going like, oh my God, at what they were seeing in the distance happening.
Yes. Well, the Germans were very, very afraid of the paratroopers. They had heard stories that they were cutthroats, that they were people would be released out of prison so they could become paratroopers or they would have to stay in prison. These things are all just fanciful. But the paratroopers were very, very fit. They were very well trained, and they proved to be quite excellent fighters. So the Germans had reasons to worry that the paratroopers were coming.
Yeah, and these were kind of, when you think of almost a Hollywood movie of what elite paratroopers would do once they landed, even in that melee of what was going on, they're like, okay, we're just going to jump into action because the U.S. paratroopers have been trained in these small combat units and they didn't need all of this, like, okay, here's the commander telling you what to do. And they just kind of got to business once they landed, even in all of that chaos.
One person in Normandy, when they first encountered paratroopers, suggested that they reminded them from a movie of men out of the Wild West. You know, that they had a kind of daring do about them, and they had all this equipment all attached to them, and they had these jump boots, etc. They just seemed something out of a movie to them, and so it was quite it was quite an experience. Now, in the village we're speaking about of Grenya, Grenya was a village of 900 souls, about 10 miles from Karata. It's a very isolated village. It had existed for 1,000 years. It was lowland, but probably at or below sea level, with one hill where there was an old 12th century Romanesque church. It was an unoccupied village, but it was amazing to the villagers. And this was what they considered a very isolated town. When I did my interviews, one person told me, I thought I lived at the end of the earth here in Grenya. Wow. That it was just amazing to them that 165 paratroopers just came floating down all around their village. Now, they were a few miles from the village, but they all headed towards the center of the village because the center of the village was 15 meters higher than the rest of the whole land and had this wonderful church. So they all sort of headed towards it. But it was an astonishing experience, something they could never imagine. They could hear all of the firing going on. They knew something was coming. Some of the villagers were in the know and were attached to the resistance. They had a sense that the invasion was coming in the next day or two. But it was just a sense of amazement that all of these paratroopers land near their village, which is unoccupied, but is filled with people who are very angry about what they call the Germans occupying their country.
Can you imagine that? Hearing what was going on, hearing all the action on D-Day, and you're kind of just off in the distance, but you could hear it, and you've been building that sense for days. That I can't imagine what that must have felt like. And then all of these guys just drop in.
Even more amazing for one family is that the paratrooper knocked on their door and sent in French to them. We are here to free you. We are like the Tommies, or we are the Tommies. We're here to free you. And what's most amazing, this was Sergeant Broussard from Tijon, Louisiana, and he spoke an accent that was used in Normandy. And so all of a sudden, they're hearing this person speak to them in a Norman accent.
That is crazy.
That was quite amazing.
I can't even begin to imagine what that would have felt like. And these people in Grenya, even if it was like an unoccupied, specific, small area, the entirety, essentially, of France was occupied by the Nazis at this point. And
correct.
They're
Nazis everywhere around the village, but not in the village, per se.
Right. And these villagers, or at least their family members, would have had contact with Nazis, and not good contact. And so it's not like, oh, the Nazis, I've heard of them. It's they're still being affected. And you talked about some of their farm animals being stolen, you know, and certainly the Nazis were very well known for their reprisals. If anything happened, they would just execute like 100 people in retaliation. And this would have affected people, I'm sure, in that village.
Among the villagers, the frustration and anger was growing. The Germans the rationing was getting worse and worse. There was less food available. The Germans were stealing their livestock. The Germans were also trying to find young men to draft them and send them to Germany to work in factories. So many young men were hiding. Within the village were a lot of veterans of World War I who had defended France against Germany during World War I. In addition, there were young men from the village who were being held hostage in Germany at the end of the war in 1940 between Germany and France. The Germans held French prisoners as sort of hostages. So all of this anger was building up within the population. Yeah. And things were simply getting worse. And, you know, desire for liberation was growing.
I can imagine. So then the villagers, they all get together and they're like, you know what? We dealt with the Germans in World War I, and now we're dealing with the Germans again in World War II. Let's all vote on even though the Nazis could just kill us all, and they will definitely kill us all if they find out that we helped U.S. soldiers. They all voted to help them anyways.
Right. Two things kind of happened simultaneously. The commanding officer, when he realized the situation, they were so far off target, came to the conclusion that they could never get back to their original mission. So he decided they would stay in the village and defend until such a time as men from Omaha Beach could reach them. But his decision was enhanced by the fact that the villagers were extremely enthusiastic that this incredible situation happened, that 165, 180 paratroopers had landed in their midst. And they immediately went out into the swamps. They went out and found the parachutes that carried the equipment of this particular group of men, which included mortars, machine guns, medical equipment, communications. They took the men who were, many of them were very wet from having landed in the swamps. They took them into their homes and they gave them some calvados to drink. They brought them to the warm fires so they could dry out, etc. They showed enormous enthusiasm, which then tended to reinforce the commanding officer's decision that we should stay and protect the people of this village. In addition, so the men, as you suggested, the men of the village met the day after on June 7th in the church, and they voted unanimously to support the paratroopers. They were supported by the acting mayor, but also they were supported by the village priest who had been a medic during World War I. In addition, the woman of the village vowed to cook for the paratroopers, and they organized a round-the-clock cooking campaign to provide two hot meals to the paratroopers. And these women, over the next several days, would go into occupied towns and surreptitiously buy food, put it in their wagons, cover the wagons, and go right by German checkpoint and bring the food and cook the food. And the children of the village would bring the food out to the paratroopers, who began to build a perimeter around the village. They dug in, they had foxholes, etc. So the village became united with the paratroopers. Now, there's one other thing that people should know is that in many ways, this was a very conservative community. Normally, we think of people who resist as being on the political left in France. These are conservative Catholics. They knew each other. Some people had been in the village. Their ancestors had been there for 1,000 years. And they were very strong Catholics. And they tended to believe that at certain times, as at Fatima, that divine beings would speak to villagers. And they more or less interpreted this amazing phenomenon of all these paratroopers landing in their village as a sign from God. Indeed, 20 years after the fact, in a homily, the parish priest, a different parish priest this time, now 20 years, it's 1964.
Yeah.
He said in his homily that the paratroopers coming to the village of Grenya was comparable to God sending his only son, Jesus, to earth.
Wow.
He drew an analogy. And so In some cases, I think that the villagers believe that.
It's hard not to.
In fact, on June 11th, in the church service, which is the day that the Nazis do attack the village, the parish priest was speaking about the miracle at Fatima, where in Catholic doctrine, the Virgin Mary came to earth to speak to three Portuguese children during World War I. There's all these kind of combinations that lead the paratroopers and the people of the village to unite. The people had had enough of German occupation, and they felt that it was now time to act. And they had been given the opportunity beyond what does it mean when the men said they're going to support them? The men help find all the equipment out in the swamps. They also go out on reconnaissance missions with the paratroopers over the next several days and explain where Germans are. That is to say, they act with Carter. They actually wanted to carry arms, and the paratroopers told them, no, that would mean you are a spy, you're not in uniform, shot immediately, caught by the Germans. But that's the enthusiasm. There were a couple, I think, villagers that left. They didn't want any part of it, but no one was against it. Anyone who stayed was in favor of supporting the paratroopers.
It's incredible. And it really is hard not to believe that there's some sort of divine, like you would feel, I would feel in that situation that there was some divine hand at work bringing these paratroopers right there. And you can, especially because you can hear everything going on with D-Day and you know what's going on. These are the liberators. And it's not like, here's some random guys, maybe we'll fight the Nazis. It's like, okay, that's now or never. This is the part where everybody's fighting back. And it really seemed like this cohesive kind of thing like you were talking about, and everybody was all in.
When I ask people, well, why did you do this? Because when they did this, they were risking everything. They are risking their town. They're risking their way of life. They're risking their children. They're risking their businesses because the Nazis would destroy everything. And in the end, they did. But when I asked people that, they seemed surprised by the question. What they said were kind of two answers. Why wouldn't we help people who are trying to liberate us? That was one answer. The second answer is, I believe in the ideals of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, fraternity. And these are men who believe in the ideals of the American Revolution, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. As I often like to say, these are ordinary people doing extraordinary things, doing extraordinary.
That's a great way to put it.
Risking everything for these ideals. I mean, we live in a kind of polarized, cynical time. And it's kind of nice to read about people who didn't express any specific political ideas, but express adherence to the ideals of both the American and French Revolution.
Yeah, you definitely can see that spirit in there. It definitely has these echoes of both of those revolutions. And it's interesting because it was Americans and Frenchmen coming together. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the Rigaud family. You go over that family quite a bit in the book, and I don't want to give too much away, but there is a central character, and this kind of highlights what we're talking about, the risks that you take. It brings in on a personal level, where there was a 12-year-old girl, and she and her sister decided to hide U.S. paratroopers in their barn, knowing that their grandfather had fought in World War I and had hidden people, helped British soldiers evade Germans in World War I. And he told them, he had warned them, you guys, like, the Nazis are going to shoot us if you do this. We're all going to die. And this 12-year-old girl and her sister was like, we have to help these paratroopers. And then they later told their parents what they were doing. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
This comes after the first few days were quite successful of the paratroopers protecting the village. And it seemed things would run work out. By June 9th, a couple of men from Omaha Beach had actually wandered into the village. So there was a sense that, well, the Americans are coming. But on June 11th, members of the 17th Waffen SS Division attacked the village. And ultimately, they had more men, they had more equipment, they had more long-range artillery, etc., and were able to overrun the village. So then it was a question of the villagers saving the paratroopers.
Right.
And in one case, the Rigaud family, led by their two daughters, Odette, who was 19, and Mark, who was 12, hid 21 paratroopers in their barn for 3 days and tried as best they could, surreptitiously feeding them. Why did they do it? Well, Mark Rigaud is still alive today, and she would just say, well, I believe in liberty, equality, and fraternity. And though she was only 12, as was just recently said about her, valor does not wait upon. And so they risked, and then in the end, their father and grandfather agreed and that they had to support the paratroopers. They were very nervous about it, and we were able to help them escape, but they risked everything. And the village risked everything. And when I say that the village risked everything, ultimately the Nazis found that the priest and his brother were assisting the American medics in helping wounded Americans after they were attacked on June 11, June 12. And they were murdered by the Nazis. The two housekeepers were murdered by the Nazis. 40 people were lined up against the wall and said, talk, who have you been helping? And none of them would talk. None of them would talk. The Nazis captured some Americans that were defending the village, and they executed 19 of them. If they had caught the 21 in the barn, they would have executed them. They ultimately burned the town down to the ground. They drove all of the villagers out of their village. To this day, no one has ever expressed any regret for what they did. They believed
That's
in
incredible.
Liberty, equality, fraternity, that this was a mission that had been handed to them, and they had to do it. Now, again, for your listeners, one of the 21 paratroopers hidden is my father. And so I consider Mark Rigaud, the one person living, is as my second mother. Because without the Rigaud family, I wouldn't exist. My daughter wouldn't exist. My grandchildren wouldn't exist.
And you're close with them to this day.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's an overwhelming experience.
Yeah.
To meet someone who made your grandchildren's lives possible.
That's
and
beautiful.
And finally, there have been a variety of awards for the Rigaud family over time. It's amazing to go into their house and you see a letter from General Eisenhower thanking the family for helping American troops. There are letters from Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama to the family. And
amazing.
Finally, the French government did as much as the American government has done. On October 21st this year, Marthe, who's the last survivor, who's 92, on behalf of her entire family, accepted the Legion of Honor, which is kind of a cross of the Presidential Medal of Freedom and the Congressional Medal of Honor. You know, so at 92, she got this magnificent medal. And it is France's highest honor.
That's incredible. Someone that's still living who was there
and who can still speak about it.
Not only Emily could she speak about it. She is 92. When she speaks about it, she becomes visibly younger as she begins to remember the days of 1944 when she was 12, when she and her sister Odette, who passed a few years ago, was 19, saved all these paratroopers. Odette drove a wagon filled with weapons that had been found out in the swamps, right into the village, right past Germans.
Can you imagine that?
I mean, no, the courage is incredible. And again, what I would emphasize to people who might listen, hopefully might want to buy the book or at least read the book, is that this is ordinary people doing extraordinary things. They're not political. They're not partisan. And they did so because they believe in the common ideals of both the French and American Revolution.
It's an incredible, incredible story of courage and bravery, just like you were saying, just of ordinary people and what people, ordinary people are capable of. You don't have to be trained as a soldier to have this kind of courage. And I thought it was kind of funny. One of the stories you were saying was like, when the Nazis were there, they had come to the village, which I'll ask about actually a little bit in a moment here, but they're there and they've got all these paratroopers hidden in their barn and like 30 Nazis come to their house and like, knock, 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 where's the paratroopers? And we're going to kill you basically if we find out that you're lying or that you're helping. And the mom had the tenacity to be like, yeah, they went that away. And it was like a total lie. They were in her barn and she just misdirected, like, these are not the droids you're looking for, to the literal Nazis at her doorstep. That's crazy.
The mom, Mark Rigaud, had a surprise when she was in her mid-40s, and she had a two-year-old. She was risking the life of a two-year-old, Claude,
who's
still with us today. He doesn't, of course, remember anything about it.
Wow, of course.
But she was risking his life in letting the paratroopers stay in the family barn. Indeed, at one point, another group of Nazis came by, and she had the wisdom and courage to say to go to the Nazis who were heading towards her barn, oh, don't go this way. Go this way, because if you go this way, you'll get your feet wet. So if you go around here, you'll keep your feet dry. You know, it's just... And the Germans went by. And the other thing to remember is the people who attacked the village on June 11th and June... Well, were not just normal German troops. These were the Waffen-SS. Some of the officers had trained at the concentration camps. These were people who fought terror war. They didn't operate by the normal rules of war, the normal codes of war. Anybody they captured, any American they captured, they murdered. And they executed some of the villagers. And when I say they executed some of the Americans, they took 9 American prisoners who had not been wounded. And they took them to another village, had them dig their own graves, kneel down, and shoot them in the back of the head.
That was very common for that.
Yeah, and they found several other Americans who were wounded, and those who could walk, they forced into a pond, bayoneting them. Some of them still alive with bayonets sticking out of them, forced them into a pond. I mean, these were not soldiers, they were murderers. And so the people of the village are risking their lives, and it's not just the Rigaud family, were risking their lives when this was the type of occupation they were being subjected to, or the type of danger they were being subjected to. And again, it seems almost incredible, but it's all true. It's all true. I didn't make up any of this story. I mean, the story had been more or less known for 60 years, but I'm the first person to kind of put it all together. And of course, what gave me a particular insight is that one of the paratroopers was my father. And then I was able to be, since all the paratroopers had passed, able to contact the children of the paratroopers and get all the kinds of information, memoirs, whatever they had. In addition, we have the other perspectives and that the villagers had left memoirs. Some of the Rigaud family was still alive. And then we were able to obtain through the one kind of mirror of Grenier, the transcripts of the Germans.
Oh.
Waffen-SS.
Oh.
Who attacked the village. Now, I don't speak German, but my wife studied in German. And she took a long, hard year translating these logbooks of the Germans. So we were able to have three perspectives, the French, the German, and American, which I think makes the different. But
Definitely.
Know, truly, the book is more focused on what the citizens of the village did. Mm-hmm. The subtitle, Resistance, Courage, and Solidarity in a French Village, and particularly an emphasis that's often not been pointed out enough, is those who resisted in Normandy, those who resisted throughout Europe, were women, not just men, were women.
Yeah.
And they had often been ignored in history, even, for example, that in terms of the breaking up the German codes of enigma, et cetera, at Bletchley Park. We often focus on Alan Turing and his development of the first computers. But most of the code breakers were British women. And many of the resistance fighters were French women.
Yeah.
And that had been long ignored in history. And so it's an emphasis on the French citizens. And in particular, the French women, for example, the French women who cooked for the paratroopers for the full week, around the clock.
Brought in the weapons and all of those kinds of
hiding
things.
Hiding the weapons in swamps, et cetera, yes.
Misdirecting the Nazis.
Misdirecting the Nazis.
So there were, how many Nazis are we talking about that are coming towards, now they know the paratroopers are in this village, and there's thousands, right, of Nazis coming?
Well, the entire division had thousands. What particularly attacked the village was one battalion. So it was about 900 against 165 or so, 170.
You said they were out, the U.S. paratroopers were outgunned.
5-1.
Right.
And the paratroopers held them off for three assaults. The third assault, they ran out of ammunition. Their decision to stay meant they were going to be riffed of army, of tank support, of artillery support, of air support. And so they didn't have any of that. They had to depend on what they had jumped with. Now, they had jumped with, they thought, sufficient equipment in terms of the machine guns and the two mortars, but they soon ran out of ammunition. They ran out of mortars, they ran out of machine gun ammunition, et cetera, so they simply couldn't fight. Now, again, of this 160, 170 men, about 110 survived. About 50, 55 died, with about 19 of them being executed. But 110 of them survived. And the reason they survived is that the villagers hid them in their homes, hid them in their barns, found ways in pathways for the paratroopers to escape and gradually make their way to Carrattach. And of these 110 men, they would later continue to participate in the Normandy campaign. They would participate in the Battle of the Bulge. They would jump over the Rhine River. They would liberate Eastern European slave laborers.
Right.
And then they would do occupation in Berlin. So what the village did was, you know, contributed in a variety of ways to Allied victory. In addition, the main object of the 17th Waffen-SS division was to capture the port town of Carrattach, to recapture it from the 101st Airborne. But the paratroopers at the village grid slowed them down for a couple of days, giving the 101st Airborne time to solidify their position at Carrattach. And then when they were finally attacked 2 days later than was expected by the Germans, the 101st was able to repulse.
All these ripple effects.
These connections, all done by the bravery of the men and women of this village of 900 people.
Yeah, and not even just like you were saying with the Battle of the Bulge and slowing down the battle at Carentan and all that. You're talking about freeing thousands of people who had been enslaved by the Nazis in Eastern Europe also. Just all over the place. Yeah, just ripple effect of saving lives. That's incredible. And kind of one of the things that I want to go back to a little bit, what you were saying, is that the Nazis in general were known for war crimes throughout the war, particularly. And this particular division that was coming to Grenya was very well known for having worked in the concentration camps, and they were very well known for being absolutely ruthless. And so almost in a way, when you think about they're risking their lives, these people in the town, it's almost like you think even if you don't help the U.S. soldiers, you could die anyways, just for looking at somebody wrong or just for not even looking at somebody wrong. And you're really in this tough situation.
To emphasize the depravity of the Waffen-SS, 17th Waffen-SS, they murdered the two priests and they murdered their two 80-year-old housekeepers. And what was their crime? They were eating wounded soldiers, which means that they were carrying out the vows that the two men who wore clerical garb had taken when they became priests and aiding the afflicted. And that's what they were doing. And, you know, in other instances we have in Normandy, we have instances where German and American doctors work together to tend to the wounded soldiers, German and American. And we have instances where Germans would walk by and they would see an aid station and they would see medics who are aiding both German and American soldiers. And they would just walk by. They weren't going to bother. But these people were, the Waffen-SS was so depraved. They were fighting terror war, what historians call terror war. They weren't just seeking victory. They were trying to terrorize people. And so they murdered these four people and they murdered 19 American soldiers. These were all war crimes.
And you hear about total warfare and you think about, you know, the Civil War and that kind of thing where you have this disregard for civilians. But this is a step above that, and terror war is what you're talking about. You actually go out of your way to needlessly, senselessly murder anybody. And they tried to even cover up their war crimes. Is that right? Because they knew, they were aware.
Right. They tried to burn the bodies of the two priests who were murdered. And then what the fire got out of control, ultimately led to the entire burning of the town and the entire destruction of the town in the days after June 11th.
Which in and of itself isn't that unusual.
Very contained June 6th to June 16th when all of the paratroopers made it to safety. Those that had survived, with about 55 dying or so.
Okay, so I want to ask you a little bit about how, at the time, there were some German scholars who completely denied any war crimes being committed. And they're like, nope, didn't happen, not there. But there was enough evidence to prove that there was, indeed. And I wanted to ask you, were there convictions for the war crimes that were committed in Grenya?
In this case, in Grenya, there was an investigation. They sent U.S. military investigators in 1947, and they interviewed villagers, and they gave them accurate descriptions of what had happened. But by this time, it's too late, because most of the members of the battalion that attacked the village of Grenya had been killed in warfare. There were 900 men in the battalion. Within 6 months, it was down to 25, I think, something like that. So most of them, there were members of this division who were tried for war crimes, but not for this specific event at Grenya.
And so I wanted to ask you a little bit about your father. Did he ever talk about anything?
My father was very interesting in that he was different than some of the veterans. For the most part, veterans did not speak about their service during World War II until they were in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, until they were like, my father was somewhat different in that he didn't speak much near the end of his life, but he spoke quite a bit in the period from when he returned in 1945 until perhaps the 1960s, early 1970s. He answered any question I had. He would watch with me. I was very curious as a young man. He would watch with me shows like Victory at Sea or The World at War. And I had four uncles who were veterans, but had not participated in combat. And so my father would let me listen in when my uncles would ask my father questions about what had occurred. So I accumulated some of the knowledge that way. In addition, I went with my father to reunions and where I could hear some stories. Always the injunction to me was that I was to keep it to myself. Some of the things spoken were not necessarily particularly pleasant. My father, however, began to develop post-traumatic stress disorder, I would guess in his 40s. At a certain point, when I was a young person and he was in his 20s, he was a typical dad. We'd go swimming and he'd go swimming. He'd swim between your legs and he'd let you swim between his legs and, you know, he'd get up on his shoulders and he'd throw his water and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But beginning in his mid-40s, he became afraid of the water. He wouldn't put his head underwater. And he told my brother that the reason he didn't anymore was because whenever he saw a body of water, he saw a paratrooper drown. He actually took swimming lessons to see if he could overcome his fear of drowning or of overcome the fear that he had of seeing that these drowned paratroopers, but he couldn't do it. Basically, as I did my research, I was surprised that all of the veterans, 100% that I studied, who had been in Grenya, all of them, because they all participated thereafter, those who survived, participated in the Normandy campaign, Battle of the Bulge, jump over the Rhine River, fighting in the Rhineland area, encountering dreadful scenes of, you know, emaciated Eastern European workers, starving children in Berlin, etc. All of them suffered post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, the most common manifestation would be an excessive drinking and alcoholism. Mm-hmm. When some of the veterans came back to meet the villagers of Grenya during the last couple decades of the 20th century, the villagers were quite shocked to see how much they drank. They commented on that to me, that they drank. But others had all kinds of flashbacks, nightmares. I mentioned one who's a friend of my father, Sergeant Fred Boyle. He was unusual in that he was a married paratrooper. And his wife told their son, the Fred I married was not the Fred who came back.
Yeah.
They had all been dramatically changed by these horrible experiences.
I wonder how the descendants in Grenya, how their parents and grandparents had dealt with that kind of trauma. If it wasn't drinking, I'm sure that happened there quite a bit too.
I would guess. I did not follow that, and I probably should have. I did not follow
really
that.
Really interesting.
Because you know, they seem to have lost everything in terms of their village and their livelihood. However, as I said, I've never heard anyone express a regret.
These people came
to help us. So of course we had to help them. And to this day, the members of the 82nd 101st, not just in the village of Grenya, but throughout Normandy, are simply referred to as the liberators or Arparas. And when Mart received the Legion of Honor in October, I and my wife and the sons of Lieutenant Frank Naughton were the invited guests of honor, and we were asked to stand. And we were given, you know, riotous applause, not for us per se, but rather for our fathers.
So the memory,
yeah, the memories of our fathers. Yes,
that is incredibly uplifting. That is incredible.
That would be another thing I would tell to your listeners. If you do go to Normandy, and I would urge you to go too, because there are beautiful sites such as the American Cemetery, Colville-sur-Mer, you will find, to your, I think, satisfaction and joy, that the people there have not forgotten. 80 years after, they have not forgotten, and they are grateful to Americans, they are grateful to the British for their liberation.
And you talked just a little bit about, and again, I don't want to give away too much stuff, but you talked about how these soldiers went back and they were kind of afraid of, like, we know we let these guys down. Is it going to be bad if we go back? And they went back and they found that it was not bad, that everybody remembered and loved them for what they had done, and that they were celebrating them and they were not disappointed in the paratroopers at all.
And for the paratroopers, including some of the officers, had felt that because they retreated, they had let the people down. They had not defended the village. Well, you can't defend the village with sticks and stones against machine guns and artillery pieces. So they ran out of ammunition. But they still felt guilty that they had let the people down, and they thought the people would be angry at them, given that their village was destroyed, given that they were subjected to so much abuse by the Nazis. But they found, to their delight, to their surprise, They were perceived as heroes.
That's got to be so hard to live with that guilt.
But, you know, they were relieved of that guilt. And, you know, a lot of once they found this, many of the people, like the Rigaud family, like Martin Odette, they were brought to the United States and brought to reunion, military reunions. And as long as they could until they passed, the veterans returned to Grenya.
That is amazing. I'm so glad that they got to get relieved of that guilt, and they got to go back and they got to see that they were enduring, everlasting heroes even to this day. That's amazing. So I wanted to ask before we go here, is there any other project, any other book that we can see from you in the future that you're working on?
Well, basically, the book has done very well. It's published by Cambridge University Press. They priced it at a very low price for a hardbound. And so a lot of people bought it, and it's become kind of I've done lots of podcasts. I've been speaking with people in the film industry. Oh, maybe someday there'll be a film. No, not really. I just want people, I don't care how you get the book, because it's in public libraries. But I think I would like people to read it, because in this deeply polarized time, it's important to remember there were times when Americans acted together.
Yeah.
And it's also in these times where people would say, well, we should just let the world go to hell. there are people who still remember us for what we did during World War II. And I think if people were to read this, they would understand that the contributions that were made by Americans during World War II are still long remembered. So those are the sorts of things, you know, sorts of things. And again, as I say, it's totally bipartisan, nonpartisan. The paratroopers were not interested in politics. They were interested in getting the job done. And the people of France were interested in getting their country returned.
Try to describe that feeling that you get when you read about what these men did and how they all came together.
I wish I could have everyone meet Marc Rigaud, now 92. Because when you meet her, you feel better about life. You feel better about life.
That's awesome.
And it's just, all I can tell you is that, you know, here's a person, he's just a little old lady in one sense, but who believes in all of these ideals and acted on them when she was young.
Yeah, you kind of get a sense of that when you're looking at her, the pictures that I saw of her. I'm trying to remember what newspaper did an article on her a couple of years ago. And there's this picture of her, and she just looks like carefree, almost just this sense of just happy, full of life. And she does not look like she's in her 90s. I can say that.
And if you could show up at her house, not only would she invite you in, to better have a translator in there because she doesn't speak English, but not only would she want you to talk about the past, but she'd serve you a nice apple tart.
That's awesome. Well, I wanted to thank you again for coming on the show. And this has been super awesome. Stephen Ray, I encourage everyone to get the book, The Lost Paratroopers of Normandy. You can get it on Amazon and the library, pretty much anywhere you find books, you can get it. So thank you.